you can't generalize about recessions. A lot of people, when they think about a recession, they think about 2008, because that's really the most recent major one that we've had. I don't think the pandemic one counts. When people think of a recession, they think of banks failing and deflation and stuff like that. But all recessions are different, and this one is going to be different too.
Welcome back to Soar Financially. Welcome and thanks so much for joining us. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. We discuss the macro to understand the micro better here on this channel, and I've invited a fantastic guest to do so. He's an accomplished book author, podcast host, but also the editor of the Daily Dirt Nap. It's Jared Dillion, and we have lots to discuss today because it's a busy, busy week in the markets, especially on the macro side. We're getting a lot of data dumped on us this week, and we're trying to make sense ahead of time and to try to level expectations a little bit and see where things are headed potentially this week. Christmas is looming as well. We're 2 weeks away from, exactly 2 weeks away from Christmas Day. Really looking forward to that, of course, as well. But we got the Fed meeting, the FOMC meeting. We got CPI data coming out. We have retail sales and, of course, big bond auction this week as well. So let's discuss that. Let's bring our guest on the program. Jared, it's great for you to join us. First time on Soar Financially. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is going to be good.
Absolutely. Yeah, lots to discuss and really looking forward to this discussion here in the next 30 minutes. But Jared, before we dive into the nitty-gritty and some of the details here, let's start with a bit of a holistic question. What's the state of the economy? How confident are you these days?
The state of the economy is that it's slowing slowly, if that makes any sense. it has been slowing slowly for about a year. You've seen the 12-month moving average of non-farm payrolls moving lower. You're starting to see claims starting to pick up. The manufacturing surveys have been pretty terrible for a while. Everybody knows that this is happening. The yield curve inverted 17 months ago. And prior to that, the longest we had ever gone from a yield curve inversion to a recession was 18 months. And now it looks like it's going to take a little bit longer. But I think that we will get a recession. I think it's going to be mild. And that's basically the crux of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with the recession topic real quick before we dive into the macro data that's being dumped on us here. Why is it delayed, or why is it taking so long for sort of the lag effect to take hold?
Well, I think it's because, we dumped $3 trillion into the economy during the pandemic, and there's still a lot of that money sloshing around. I've seen a chart floating around on Twitter that talks about the excess savings that people have from the stimulus money, and it's gone from a couple trillion down to like $400 billion, which is reflected in the consumer credit data and stuff like that. So I just think it's, you can't generalize about recessions. A lot of people, when they think about a recession, they think about 2008, because that's really the most recent major one that we've had. I don't think the pandemic one counts. When people think of a recession, they think of banks failing and deflation and stuff like that. But all recessions are different. And this one is going to be different too. I think this one's going to be a little bit of a manufacturing recession. I think you're starting to see defaults pick up, corporate defaults. But at the same time, the labor market is still super strong. So, it's tough to imagine a scenario where unemployment would go above 6%, but I think if it went above 4 or 4.5%, it would get the attention of the people at the Fed. So, yeah, those are my thoughts on that.
Now, 4.5%, is that breaking? As Jerome Powell put it for you, is that breaking something? Is that already significant? In Germany, we're sitting at about 5.8, 5.9, and nobody bats an eye.
Yeah, I think, this is an election year in the United States. So I think that the Fed is going to be ultra sensitive to any weakness in the labor market. Of course, the payroll report we got last week, the unemployment rate went down to 3.7. I'm not really, into the weeds on the economics. I don't know why that happened. But I think if you printed 4% on the unemployment rate, then that would get people's attention and it would affect the trajectory of the Fed. And, you know, in terms of the Fed, I think that it's not a matter of if they will cut rates. I think it's a matter of when they will cut rates. And I think consensus now is that they will cut in March, and I believe that will happen. And it's not a function of weakness in the economy. It's a function of the fact that monetary policy is too restrictive. If you have Fed funds at 5.5% and core PCE at 2.3%, that means you have real rates of 3.2%, which is too restrictive. So I think, regardless of what the economy does, the Fed is going to cut probably 100 basis points, which is consistent with what they've been saying in the dot plots for the last couple of months.
You mentioned a bit of a rolling recession. In the you mentioned the manufacturing sector. I'm going to throw in construction as well. It's not going to be a recession that everybody feels. I like talking from experience because I'm watching what's happening here in Germany, for example. Just here in the neighborhood, a big developer just went belly up last week. A property developer, right? Building just real estate for was it private real estate, right? Do you see that taking? What sectors do you see being affected by that sort of rolling recession? It started with trucking and freight in the US, I think. What's next?
Well, I think housing could potentially be next. You're seeing a really big divergence. You know, the housing market is starting to roll over, somewhat belatedly. You know, one of the things that really got people confused was the fact that interest rates or mortgage rates went to 8%. And the housing market remained strong for a really long time. Well, now it's starting to roll over. I'm actually trying to sell a house, and it's not a musical comedy. Like, it's actually been very difficult. So the housing market is rolling over, and meanwhile, the home building stocks are at all-time highs, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And that's going to resolve itself one way or another. So, you know, I think that's an anomaly.
Absolutely. No, it doesn't make any sense at all. Like, who can afford 8% mortgage rates these days? Like, nobody's really calculated with that. And in the US, I think a lot of shorter term mortgages as well. Like, what's the common average mortgage term in the US?
The average more, I mean, the vast majority of people get 30-year fixed
Fixed? Yeah.
mortgages, 30-year fixed, the vast majority. I'm building a house, so I got a construction loan. I locked in the rate about a year and a half ago. It's 4.25% on a 10-1 ARM. So it's adjustable after 10 years. So I'm locked in for 4.25 for 10 years, which is a pretty good deal. So.
So it's mostly the new home buyers that are being affected, right? So it's not existing. There's no, it's like it's not the short-term rollovers. Because I know in Canada, for example, it's a bit different. It feels like there's a lot more variable debt or variable mortgages. A lot of shorter term, like 1 to 3 year mortgage. I've seen that in Vancouver quite often.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that's unique about the United States housing market is that, you know, I think one of the greatest financial innovations of the 20th century was the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. You know, the ability for somebody to lock in an interest rate over 30 years and to have the option to prepay has really, I mean, it's really led to stability in the US housing market that other countries don't see. I mean, most countries have adjustable rates in one way or another, and they're sort of at the mercy of the bond market. And in the United States, we're not. Even though mortgage rates have gone up significantly, the average mortgage rate in the United States right now is about 3.5% because people locked them in or refinanced when rates were about 2.5% during the pandemic.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, perfect. I mentioned in my intro, we got a lot of data being or coming out this week. I mentioned Fed, CPI, retail sales, but also bond auctions happening this week. Out of the four, which one is the most important to you this week?
Definitely the Fed. I mean, we're going to get some clues as that's where you're going to start to get some visibility as to whether they're actually going to cut rates in March. You know, the thing with this, we've had this pattern at the Fed meetings where the directive comes out somewhat dovish, and then Powell gets in front of the microphone at the press conference and starts dropping bombs all over the place. This time might be no different. I think. You know, I've been watching the Fed for over 20 years, and in an environment where you have some inflation, there's always this boilerplate language that the Fed uses that they have to be vigilant about inflation. And I think people interpret that as a hawkish statement. You know, like Powell, even just last week at that fireside chat, said that the Fed is ready to raise rates basically if the data starts to get hot. And they're really not. They're not. They're done raising rates. You know, they've several Fed governors have specifically said they're done raising rates. So that's not, you know, that's boilerplate language, and people get all excited about it, and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I think he's trying to keep the market in check as well, because if he says we're going to start cutting rates, the market is going to go ballistic. Absolutely, right? I'm just looking at the Fed Watch tool here as well. 1.6% chance of a rate hike. Is that the what's a good word for it? The people that believe him that do believe that.
Credulity. 1.6% chance of a rate hike at this meeting. I think that chance is zero.
I was going to say,
I
like, what
would.
are the Vegas odds for that?
Yeah.
So, really, really interesting. But you mentioned March a couple times, and I need to follow up on that, like, because there's one more meeting, or actually, we have this meeting this week, then we have one in January, and then March 20th. Why do you say March? Why not January or even May, for example?
Well, you know, I think that if we had had a weak payroll report last week, I think a March cut would have been more likely. If we had a weak payroll report in December, January, and February, then it would have been pretty much a sure thing that we would have cut rates in March. But the payroll report was not weak. It wasn't really strong, but it was above expectations. And I think that reduces the probability for a March rate cut. But I think it still depends on the data, you know.
No, absolutely. Okay. Interesting, because I'm just following through here as well, because a lot of people predict, like, oh, you mentioned as well, like a 1% or 100 basis point cut next year. And I'm just counting the meetings. There's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven meetings next year. So they might have to cut it at least four of the meetings. I'm really curious how that's going to play out. CPI, of course, is a big factor that goes into like the Fed decision making here as well. And we get some CPI data this week here as well. Did we beat inflation, Jared? Did we beat it, like Paul Krugman said?
So in the short term, yes, in the long term, no. And we were successful in bringing inflation down, but we did not break the inflationary psychology. Okay. Inflation is a monetary phenomenon, like Milton Friedman said, but it's also a psychological phenomenon. If people believe that there is inflation, they will take actions to perpetuate inflation. Okay. They will buy faster, they will buy more, they will act in such a way that causes prices to go up. And that's why inflation expectations are so important. And I think on Friday we got some the University of Michigan survey, we got some information on inflation expectations, and inflation expectations are coming down quite a bit, and the Fed pays attention to this. But even still, like, you know, there is a risk here. If the Fed cuts 100 basis points, 200 basis points, and inflation goes back up, we're going to have to go through this all over again, and we're going to end up with, you know, 10-year rates of 7, 8, 9%, and it's going to be a nightmare. And I don't think, in order to break the inflationary psychology, you need to engineer a recession that is severe enough that people stop expecting price increases. And that's really the beauty of what Volcker did in 1980, is that he raised interest rates so much. You know, that recession in the early 80s was negative 6% GDP. It was a very, very severe recession, and that broke the inflationary psychology. So we didn't do that this time. And we still, I mean, just talk to an average person. You know, people believe that there is inflation. Even though inflation has come down from 9% to 3%, people still have this psychology ingrained in their head.
Absolutely. I was in the US last week as well, and bought a cup of Starbucks coffee, grande, not the venti, grande, just black coffee, and a couple egg bites. I paid $15 for it at the hotel. So tell me we've beaten inflation. Please tell me. Like, and you take the 20% hotel fee on top of that. Like, take that off. Like, it's still $12.50, $13 for a cup of coffee, black coffee, and a couple egg bites, like two eggs pretty much microwaved. Unbelievable. Try finding a breakfast place like that charges less than $15 a plate these days.
Yeah.
So it's just for a couple of eggs, some hash browns, maybe a couple strips of bacon. I have a hard time finding that. Like, it's interesting. So if we talk about inflation, I look at that and I was like, no, that doesn't make any sense, especially
I
now.
think people, this is what I hear all the time. I live in South Carolina. This is not a financial hub by any means. We just have very average people here, like real estate appraisers and people who work in service industries and stuff like that. And they talk about going to the grocery store and they're like, look, like I have like half a cart full of stuff. Like I can still see the bottom of the cart. I have like half a cart full of stuff and it's $230, and people have a memory of what it was like before the pandemic when it was $110. And they say we still have inflation, even though the rate of inflation has come down quite a bit.
I don't know. Another example is chapstick. $4.50 for a Burt's Bee, and it doesn't. It's insane. I'm not sure what is going on. That blew my mind last week. Like, it's brutal. Like, it is a nice reality check, right? Talking about that, retail sales, I think, is a big one that's coming out this week as well. And looking at my consumer behavior, I'm slowing down spending if I see chapstick for $4.50.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a prediction on retail sales. I mean, if I were to predict, I'd say they'd be kind of flat and not super exciting. The Black Friday sales were basically flat to last year when you take inflation into account. I think holiday shopping is pretty flat. So people are slowing down consumption because of inflation, but not a lot. So I think out of all the numbers we're getting this week, I think retail sales is probably the least important. For sure, it's the Fed and CPI.
Gotcha. Bond auctions. I know you're following the bond market quite closely as well. We have to talk about that. Is that a big a black swan event looming, or is that business as usual this week?
Do you know what maturities are being offered?
I think part of it is 30 years. There's
30,
some.
it's going to be a 30-year bond
Yeah.
auction. Well, I can tell you that one of the risks to bond auctions this week is that rates have done, come down quite a bit. So if you look at a 30-year bond at 4.3% versus 5%, it's a lot less attractive. And I don't know the size of the auctions. I haven't really paid like super close attention to bond auctions since 2009, but since rates have come down a lot, I'm guessing these auctions are going to be less attractive. I mean, I don't really see a scenario where we have a failed auction or a super weak auction or anything like that. But if you start seeing auctions with a bid to cover below two and they're kind of sloppy auctions and they tail by like 5 or 6 basis points, I mean, that is a possibility, but.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Like, I'm not a big expert on it as well, but just something we've been discussing here on the channel a bit as well is just bonds and the bond market, because I think it's 110 billion they're trying to issue this week. So it's not a
Yeah.
small amount, right? So that's why I'm keeping an eye on it just as that black swan event, just for something. I don't know. Like I mentioned to you in the intro, we're always so gloomy or like doomy here. We're always looking for something to break the system and, cause a crash or something. We should be looking out for something gloomy. Like, Jared, since I have you, like, what is something gloomy you're looking at these days? Like, where are you putting your money to work?
What is something gloomy I'm looking at? Well, I think that stocks are going to peak very, very soon, probably next week. I'm going to be looking to put on a short of some kind. Sentiment has gotten very extended on the bullish side. Like if you look at the surveys, like the bulls have gone up, the bears have gone down. Starting to see some victory laps on Twitter by the index fund guys. You're starting to see distribution. If you look at the price action intraday, we've had several days where the market opens on the highs and closes on the lows, which is a sign of distribution. So yeah, I think, looking at the charts, I think we're going to peak sometime next week. And then it potentially could get a lot ugly.
So one last Christmas rally here, and then a bit of a reset for the new year. Is that really just people chasing performance and having saying, hey, we own the Magnificent Seven in our portfolio? Is that just part of it?
Well, I don't think anybody owns those stocks because they want to own them. I think they own them because they have to own them. Because if you don't own them, then you're going to underperform. And it's led to this sort of herd mentality. I've talked about this in my newsletter, like, even if I thought that Apple was the best stock in the world, it was going to a $5 trillion market cap, I wouldn't recommend it in my newsletter because you can do that on your own. You really don't need help doing that. And it's just going to make your portfolio more pro-cyclical. The highs are going to be higher, the lows are going to be lower, and you're going to experience more volatility. You know, I try to look for uncorrelated stuff. That's what I do for a living. So,
for example,
like Argentina. Like, okay. Argentina has been a big theme in my newsletter for going back about 8 months. You know, that was one geopolitical situation that I studied very closely. I said early on, very early on, before Milei was even picked up by the press, I said this guy had a chance of winning. So that's been not to pound my chest, but that's been a great uncorrelated trade for the newsletter. So
how did you trade it, if I may ask? Did you buy Argentine pesos or FX? Like, how'd you play that trade? Just curious.
No, I bought stocks. Okay. I still own them. YPF and GGAL. So an oil company and a bank. Okay.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Cause Argentina is one of the, I wouldn't call them a black swan, but an interesting event that happened this year. Cause they want to peg the currency to the dollar, get rid of the peso and reintroduce the dollar, opening their markets a bit. And of course the new president is a bit of a libertarian. So he's already closed down some departments and ministries, and he wants to change things up. So really curious what that does on a global scale as well. Jared, like, you host a podcast as well, and one of the theory or one of the titles is "Finance is full of conspiracy theories," right? So I got to ask you, like, what is the biggest one, or what is one of the conspiracy theories that you've uncovered here?
There's two big ones. One of them is the Plunge Protection Team, right? The PPT, which everybody was talking about in 2017, like the mid 2010s. People noticed that the market would rip from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock into the close. And they said, this can't be real. You know, there is a president's working group on financial markets, and there's a lot of bank CEOs and hedge fund leaders that are part of that group. And that's kind of the genesis of the Plunge Protection Theme conspiracy theory. But people actually believe that there's a guy at the New York Fed sitting in an office buying S&P E-minis, like ripping them into the close, and that the Fed owns like billions of dollars, trillions of dollars worth of stock. And I'm like, you know, like, if that were true, then somebody would have to roll those futures, and the roll would be like completely distorted. Like, you would definitely, and it would show up in the commitment of traders. Like, you can't conceal that type of activity. So you don't hear people talking about, you know, we had a bear market, so nobody talks about the Plunge Protection Team anymore.
No, so. Exactly right. Interesting. Yeah. Conspiracy theories is a good segue to gold as well, because the gold space is full of them as well. But we have to talk about the yellow metal and the precious metal here. Recently marked all-time high, Jared. Like, what do you make of that? Like, because we couldn't hold it, and we're below $2,000 again today. What does the gold price tell you these days?
I hold gold, but I don't trade it. I haven't traded it ever. I think if I traded gold, I would probably be broke. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it's really, really hard to trade. And every time I have an opinion on gold, it turns out to be wrong. The Sunday before, when gold, you know, ran some stops in Asia and put in that high around 2135, like, you know, I was counting my money, and I said, you know, this is great. You know, gold trades very technically, in that it was an ugly candle and they called it a hanging man. And now people are pressing on the short side. Like, you know, I just try to tune out all this stuff and think about it in terms of decades. Right. And when I started to buy gold in 2005, really the thesis was that gold would outperform stocks over a lifetime, right? Not over 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, like really over a lifetime of investing. And not to get into too much detail, but I was seeing some things politically that led me to believe that. And I still believe that. So yeah, I mean, I have a large position, and right now it's putting in new lows. It's trading around 1983, and it's, you know, it's super frustrating. So
tell me about it. I'm on the mining side here as well, and I'm just looking at all the, like, the little gains that we made last week are just disappearing. Right, are just evaporating, because it's all back to, like, as you said, doom and gloom. Like, nobody believed in you know, the break above the all-time high level there. Absolutely devastating, to be honest. It's demoralizing to a degree. Jared, you have a new book coming out in January called No Worries, and it kind of fits because it's you know, beginning of the new year, and you're talking about you know, financial freedom, and you're sort of liberating yourself from the markets a bit. How does that fit in with the forecast for 2024 as well? And how timely is that advice?
Well, the subtitle of the book is How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. And this isn't, it's not really an investing book. It's really more of a personal finance book. And I talk about how the two biggest activators of financial stress are debt and risk. Okay. So if you have a lot of debt, you're going to have a lot of stress. If you have a lot of risk, you're going to have a lot of stress. And if you don't have debt and risk, you don't have stress. Doesn't matter how much money you have. Like, you could be broke living paycheck to paycheck, and if you don't have debt and you don't have risk, you're a happy person. Like, you're totally stress-free. Then on the other hand, you have a guy like Elon Musk, the richest guy in the world, who leveraged up to buy Twitter, and then Tesla went down 75%, and he almost got a margin call. And, you know, the richest guy in the world almost went tits up, you know? So, and that was self-inflicted. And a lot of people, like, when they structure their financial affairs, they structure them in such a way that actually increases their financial stress. And I try really hard not to do that. You know, it's funny you mentioned gold. Like, as volatile as gold is, it's really not any more volatile than stocks. And really for the last couple of months, except for the last couple of weeks, it was less volatile than stocks, you know? So a lot of people put gold into that bucket of risky investments, but it's really not, you know? It's kind of slow and boring. So
absolutely. Yeah. It's an insurance policy. That's what that is. Like, it's,
yeah.
Right. Depends on how you buy it. Of course, if you buy paper gold, that's more of a trade, but if you buy physical, that's more of an investment, and you can put aside and don't have to worry about it. Right. Lift the skirt on the book a little bit. Like, what are some of the key chapters? What are you most proud of? Or, like, what is one of the key takeaways that you want the reader to take away from it?
Well, one of the key takeaways, you know, there is a personal finance industry in the United States. You have Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman, and then you have, on top of that, you have thousands of personal finance bloggers, you know, and YouTubers and all that stuff. They all say the same thing. They all say the same thing. If you don't buy coffee at Starbucks, then you will have enough money for retirement. Right.
Back to Starbucks, like, again. If I would have saved those $15, Jared.
If you stop buying coffee at Starbucks, you will have enough for retirement. So, you know, it's funny, like, I drive into work every day and I get a coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and it's $3.70. And I work 250 days a year, so that's $900 a year. And if I didn't drink coffee for 40 years, that's $36,000. And if I put it in an index fund, I would maybe make $150,000. So if I stopped buying coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, I would have $150,000 at retirement. So that is true. That is true. But people cannot give up small luxuries. Any program which asks you to give up a small luxury like coffee is not going to work, because you can't sustain that over a long period of time. As it turns out, if you do the math, the little stuff like the coffee and generic brand soup and all that stuff, it doesn't matter. What matters is, what kind of house do you buy, right? If you get a 2,400 square foot house instead of a 2,800 square foot house, and you pay $100,000 less, you will save $120,000 in interest over the life of the loan, which is like like three lifetimes of coffee. So the little stuff just does not matter. In the United States, we are taught that it's the little things that matter, right? Whether you make your bed in the morning, turning off the lights when you leave a room. That stuff does not matter at all. It doesn't matter at all. It's the big stuff. It's your house, it's the car, and it's student loans. And that is it. That's all that matters, not any of this other stuff.
Fantastic. Interesting. And the book is already available for pre-order. So since it's Christmas and holidays here, we'll put a link below, hey? Absolutely. You can already order it on Amazon, coming out January 23rd, next year. Talking about next year, Jared, let's sort of put a summary around the conversation here and provide a bit of a forecast. Like, what do you expect to happen in 2024? You hinted at the rate cuts, but overall, like the economy, markets, I've seen a lot of predictions from other analysts, like on Bloomberg and Reuters, like, hey, we're going to have a great rally into the new year, and then things are going to tank come maybe second half of the year. Do you have a similar prediction?
I do have a similar prediction. I think that's about right. But one thing I will point out is that there is some seasonality around the election, and stocks tend to do well in the fourth year of a president's term, for obvious reasons. I don't think that's going to be the case this time. I think stocks are going to struggle next year. And I think rates are going to be lower. I think 10-year rates are going to go down to about 3.5. I think 2-year rates are going to go down to about 2.5. I'd like to make a prediction on gold, but I have no idea what's going to happen there.
No, fantastic. Awesome. No, Jared, really, really appreciate your time. I know you're extremely busy. I see your podcasts and interviews and your book tours everywhere. So I really appreciate you making the effort and coming on. Where can we find more of you? I know we're going to link to the book below, but on a more regular basis.
Definitely go to the book, buynoworries.com, pre-order a copy. And if you want to check out the newsletter, it's www.dailydirtnap.com.
Quick question, Jared, while I have you. What does daily dirt nap mean? Dirt nap? Maybe it's a language
So
thing.
I started my career on the Pacific Coast Options Exchange, and it was kind of a there was a lot of surfers on the floor. They would be done working at one and they would go surfing. So the floor kind of had its own lexicon, and dirt nap was a term for the market going down. So you would see these surfer guys staring at the screen, and they'd be like, "Dude, the spoos are taking a hella dirt
Okay,
nap."
I thought it was a language thing because I'm German. I'd never heard that word, so because I know what dirt and nap is, but put together, no clue. So interesting, awesome. No, I appreciate that, Jared. Again, thanks so much for your time. Thank you so much for coming on, and everybody else. Thank you so much for joining us here on Soar Financially. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure to hit that subscribe button, hit that like button as well. That way, we can invite guests like Jared more regularly on the program. And of course, go check out his book. We're going to link it to it down below here on Amazon, and tell your friends. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll be back with lots more. Thank you so much.